7.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on the Prime Media Plus app
and on DSTV channel 856.
A very good afternoon to you this lovely Friday afternoon. It's 7 minutes past 12 o'clock. I'm Jane Dutton. I'm in for Mandy Wiener. And we're going to be talking about the growing number of cancer patients we're seeing in the country and the fact that 748 million was set aside in Gauteng to treat patients. And guess what? It never landed. Nobody has benefited. Why is that? You were listening to Bernadette Wicks talking about the dreadful situation thousands of students have been left in the Eastern Cape. So we're going to be speaking to her to find out more about that long, long, long walk to schools and the broken promises there. The closure of the Lesotho Highlands water tunnel. Well, that's going to be happening for 6 months. Are we prepared for that eventuality? And a real blow to the Me Too movement. In Thursday's ruling overturning Harvey Weinstein's New York rape conviction, which gives the mogul a chance at a new trial. So how much of a setback is this for us here in South Africa and for women across the world?
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Let's first talk about Senzo Meyiwa, the case that just keeps rolling on. It's been quite a dramatic week, though. Khumotso Madise, Eyewitness News reporter, has been covering this story for us. And today, quite significant because we're seeing focus on bank statements, which seems to suggest that those accused were in Johannesburg on the day.
That's right, Jane. It's an important part of the story because the defense by some of the accused is that they were not in Johannesburg on the weekend that Senzo Meyiwa was killed, particularly on the 26th of October 2014. And they're saying they could not have been part of this murder. But bank statements that have been revealed in court have shown, at least in terms or with regards to accused number one, that's Muzis Bia, that he not only was he in Joburg, or not only did he show signs of being in the area through his bank transactions, he also made purchases in the Johannesburg area that link him, or at least pin him down to certain parts of Johannesburg. And I found it very interesting that a lot of the transactions that he made, according to the statements, actually place him in Vosloorus, which is where Senzo Meyiwa was killed. It's also understood that he's been living in, or he was living at some point in a hostel in Vosloorus, which the state believes was the base that was used by the men accused of murdering Meyiwa. After they murdered him, it seems they went to the Lesotho hostel. So there's that as well. And you couple that with evidence that we heard last year about the same accused, Muzis Bia, actually going to a local, or going to a Benoni licensing department to do his license there. And the dates there are important because these dates, or it seems he was doing these transactions and these activities in 2015, 2014, and that's important because his defense is, I wasn't in Johannesburg between 2013 and I only returned at the end of 2015 because I'd lost my job.
Now, we know that the state thinks Kelly Khumalo is the one behind this, the mastermind, and yet quite a good week for her.
Well, you know, not a good week because, you know, her name keeps coming up. I mean, I don't know, actually, if I were her, what I'd do. But it just keeps coming up and questions just keep being asked about her arrest, right? So that just keeps being the question. If she's the mastermind and the state believes she's the mastermind and they've got evidence, why is she not arrested? And that's the question that came up this week again.
Okay, yeah, but what I'm actually referring to is one of the witnesses saying, oh, you know, we've got nothing to do with her and she wasn't involved. So
yeah.
I guess when it's so dire, a little bit of light there for her might have been a better way to put it.
Yes, there's a lot here around Kelly Khumalo. Just keeps, you know, of course, she just keeps coming up, right, during a really important and testimonies in court. This week in particular, the question was asked to the investigating officer, one of the investigating officers, Sergeant Batu Mokgola, why she had not been arrested yet. And she answered that she doesn't know. She knows that there was a warrant of arrest that was taken out, but it was never executed. But we know from January, during the testimony of the lead investigator, Brigadier Geninda, that quite frankly, there was a warrant, and it was the NPA that decided that should go ahead with the five men before Kelly Khumalo. So it seems she's not off the hook just yet.
What's coming up?
So more bank statements. We heard today in court that there seems to be a bit of a back and forth about which of the defense attorneys have which bank statements and if they have all the bank statements that have been that should be disclosed by the state. Some of the defense also wanting to consult with their clients. You know what's interesting here, Jane, is that some of the defense, I know the defense for accused number one, Thulani Mgomezulu, said yesterday on record that they're going to be disputing the correctness of these bank statements. I'm not sure how that works when bank statements are brought from the bank. I mean, are they saying, you know, the judge even asking, are you saying that the banks cooked these bank statements?
Sounds a little desperate.
Yes. So that's what's coming up. It's going to be really interesting next week because we'll then hear the defense from the defense. Are they saying the bank statements have been cooked? Are they saying the bank statements have been lied about? What exactly is their defense?
And you'll be the one to tell us. Khamotso Madise. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Let me tell you what has been happening today as well. The three people accused of theft of foreign currency at President Cyril Ramaphosa's Phalaphala Farm, expected to appear in the Bela Bela Magistrates Court in Limpopo. The three are facing charges of housebreaking, theft and conspiracy to steal. They allegedly stole $580,000. I think that's about 11 million rand or so. Not a small sum indeed. At the president's farm in February 2020, the National Prosecuting Authority earlier told the court that two additional arrests were imminent.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
So the DA this morning has unveiled their new groundbreaking, their words, economic policy, and its leader, John Steenhuisen, says the party's economic policy is built on getting the right people in government so they make the right decisions.
At the DA's National Manifesto launch in February, I announced that the first and most important pledge that we were making as a party to the people of South Africa in this election is to deliver 2 million new jobs and to lay the foundation for a new, rapidly growing, modern and vibrant economy. And the policy that we launched today shows why this is a credible undertaking, why it is achievable, and why it is an urgent pledge that any government that the DA will be part of after the election will deliver on. It's all built on getting the right people into government so that those people can make the better choices that South Africans desperately need. It sets out how we're going to improve the ease of doing business, which alone will unlock between 250,000 and 400,000 new jobs. Through making better fiscal choices, we will generate another 250,000 to 500,000 new jobs. Reforming labour policies through better choices, including our introduction of the Youth Employment Opportunity Certificate, will unleash hundreds of thousands more jobs for young people in South Africa.
Matt Cuthbert, DA's policy head, joins us now on the line. Matt, very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thank you for having me on your show.
How's this all going to work, this groundbreaking economic policy that's been unveiled to us?
Well, ultimately, voters need to get behind the DA as a member of the multi-party charter and vote in an opposition government that will be able to deal on the real economic form that our country requires. We know that we have one of the world's worst unemployment crises currently underway. Our debt is spiraling out of control, and we've not focused on delivering critical infrastructure required to create a conducive environment for growth and job creation. And if we get our government into place after the 29th of May, we'll be in prime position to be able to deliver on the commitments which we've made in the policy we launched this morning.
All right, say you get your wish. What's the first task on hand?
Well, the first thing that we need to focus on is making it easier for people to start up businesses. And there are a number of solutions which you propose to doing this. So not only do small entrepreneurs need easier access to microfinance so that they're able to put out their ideas and be able to develop them, but they also need to have some sort of relief on the kind of critical business tools they require to run a small business. So I'll give you one anecdote. If you are a small business owner in a very rural area of South Africa, and you are a painter or electrician or a plumber for that matter, one of the critical business tools you require is to be able to use a small single cab bucky. But yet we have import duties which protect certain industries locally from getting that good and cheaper. Now, if it was cheaper for people to be able to access these critical business tools, then they would be in a position to be able to start their businesses in an easier fashion, have the kind of tools required to move around some really, really rough terrain. And I think that by starting from that point and making sure that it's easier to start a business, stabilizing the overall economic environment, there'd be far more economic prosperity in this country.
You're promising 2 million jobs. It seems to be the magic number. That's pretty close to what many other parties are promising. What is it about that number?
So I think we need to realize that some of the more long-term interventions from the basic education perspective, particularly getting the quality of basic education right, are going to take between 10 and 15 years. And I think what we are proposing here is the key levers we can pull to try and create these jobs and ameliorate unemployment over the next 5 years. And that's why we've been very circumspect in the number that we put out. We've made sure that we've done the math to justify what it is that we are putting out to voters. And we believe that if we can start ameliorating unemployment, some of those longer-term interventions in the education sector, skills development, will actually take hold in the preceding terms. And we'll be able to ultimately get unemployment down to an acceptable level.
I know you're pushing for a policy with sustainable development goals. That's what you're calling it, to replace the broad-based black economic empowerment. How's that going to work? And who are you talking to here?
So ultimately, we agree on the diagnosis of why we find ourselves as one of the most unequal and impoverished countries in the world. And this is because of the historical injustices meted out to the vast majority of South Africans in this country. However, if we look at evidence, we would know that 30 years of race-based policies have failed to address the inequality gap and have failed to meaningfully lift people up out of unemployment, and instead have focused on enriching an elite that are linked to the governing party. And this is why we believe our alternative approach, which focuses on government procurement policy, will replace the existing BEE scorecard and focus on sustainable development goals such as decent work, such as no poverty and clean energy, on making sure that that development reaches the communities that it requires. Because at the moment, as much as we've had all of this race-based policy, it's never filtered down to people who are most in need. And this is why we have 5 million children that are starving who are predominantly black. And we also have some of the most impoverished areas in this country being predominantly black. And we believe that our non-racial alternative, which addresses the key drivers of inequality and lack of opportunity, will be able to deliver the kind of redress that our country is looking for.
DA's policy head, Matt Cuthbert, very good to talk to you. We're going to take a little break now, and then we're going to be talking about the water situation that's due to face the country when the Lesotho Highlands water tunnel closes for 6 months. Don't forget our WhatsApp number, 0727021702. That's for 702 listeners. For Cape Talk, it's 0725671567.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Hi, Jane. I find it fascinating that when money gets stolen from the president, then the perpetrators are tracked down, caught, and brought to book to face the justice system. But when politicians and people like the Guptas steal from the people of South Africa, nothing ever happens. Well, maybe not surprising. I don't know. Thanks, Dave from Pretoria.
Thank you, Dave. Good point. Yes, it is a rather confusing scenario playing out in our country. It seems that a lot of people are acting and getting away with being above the law. So we've been hearing about the Lesotho Highlands water tunnel closing for 6 months. We got more details this morning from the Department of Water and Sanitation, the Director General, Dr. Sean Phillips. On the line now, we've got Livuani Mabuda, Water and Sanitation Acting DDG for Infrastructure Management. A very good afternoon to you.
Afternoon to you and your listeners.
All right, tell us how this is going to work. It's going to start, I believe, in October and head over all the way to March next year.
Yes. This is a planned maintenance, which we do every 5 years. We have done the last one just for 2 months in 2019, and we picked up that there are issues we need to sort out. With respect to tunnel linings, especially the steel section, that are showing signs of some corrosion, which we have to shut down the tunnel now for a longer period, 6 months, as you have indicated, so that we can do this properly. We will grit blast this and clean it up and reapply corrosion protection.
Okay, what does it mean?
Any other issue we pick up during the shutdown.
Okay, so, what impact is it going to have on us here?
The analysis show that because the system consists of many dams, about 14 in total, that assist each other in making water available for rainwater to abstract, clean and supply to Gauteng and the surrounding areas, the impact will be negligible. They will still get their full licensed water, raw water for supplying the various users.
I've just got a message here, excuse me, interjecting, from somebody who hasn't put their name, just saying the water problems are the next Eskom. The Eskom debacle has been going on for over 16 years. We know that, you know, we've got problems, and so I'm leaving the message now and talking to you. We've had problems when it comes to water for many years. In fact, if anything, it gets worse. So hearing this sort of news, I must admit, fills me with fear and dread. I mean, what are your communications with the local water providers and to make sure that there is no interruption?
Yeah, we have a coordinated program of engaging with our stakeholders and also the various role players in the water value chain to make sure that our plans are aligned and that this shutdown will have very minimal impact on the users.
And so will it have minimum impact? I mean, are you confident of that?
Yes, we are very confident. We have, for instance, for the rainwater customers, we have a large dam similar in size to Vaal Dam upstream in the near Harrismith, Sterkfontein Dam, which if we see that the levels at Vaal Dam are running too low, 18% or so, we can release that water and continue to supply the users. Mm. Of course, anybody who is using water from this system is well aware that because of scarcity of water in the country, we need to be very, very prudent and
yes, I was going to ask you
any losses and the like.
What should we be doing? Firstly, paint us a picture of how much water is coming into us here in Gauteng and the surrounding areas from the Lesotho Dam, the Lesotho Highlands water tunnel. How much is coming in, and what should we be doing in this period in order to conserve the water?
Every year, we receive 780 million cubic meters of water from Lesotho Highlands, the two main dams being Katse and Mohale. During the calendar year of 2024, which a portion of which will be part of the shutdown, we will only receive 700 of these, and there will be a shortfall of only 80 million cubic meters. Now, we'll make this up in the coming hydrological years so that we receive the full quotas. But on the raw water side, in ensuring that the rainwater gets its licensed water, there isn't much that we expect you to do besides being water efficient and dealing with situations where you are asked to inform the municipality, leakages, so that we attend to these urgently, and that we don't have situations where there are obvious water losses. People must be vigilant and make sure that the water operators are maintaining the rest of the system in the so that we minimize
the impact. All right, we've been listening. This closure is going to happen from October, so it's not as though we haven't been warned, but we have been promised that the impact on us should be minimal, and possibly we won't notice it at all if it goes the right way. Livuana Mabuda, Water and Sanitation Acting DDG. Thank you very much for talking to us. Remember, our number is 072-702-1702, 4702. For Cape Talk, it's 072-567-1567.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Very good afternoon to you. Jane Dutton here, in for Mandy Wiener. Let me remind you of our numbers, 072-702-1702 for 702 listeners and 072-567-1567 for listeners in Cape Talk land. And I want you to listen to this. On the 9th of March, 2023, the Gauteng Treasury ring-fenced 748 million rand for outsourcing radiation oncology services. Yet a full year later, and no service provider has been appointed, while more than 3,000 cancer patients wait for treatment. Why not? An open letter has been written to the MEC for Finance in Gauteng, that's Nomantu Nkomoralihuku, about this travesty of justice. And two of those behind that letter, Salome Meyer, Director for Cancer Alliance, and Kanisa Mapipa from the head of, who is the head of health at Section 27, are joining us on the line. A very good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having us.
So let me start off with you. Tell us about this letter to the MEC. What drove you to write it?
Thank you, Jane, for having us. What drove us is complete inaction, nothing more than just inaction. This travesty of justice has been going on for, in fact, more than a year, because we have alerted the Gauteng Health Department about this crisis already in 2022. And in fact, even before that, however, through our work, yes, the money was allocated, so it's not an excuse to actually say that we haven't got the funding or anything like that. This is pure inaction.
Kanisa, so the money's there, and yet it's not landing. Have they explained why?
Actually, there's been no explanation as to why the money hasn't been used. This, despite our continued correspondence and continued engagement with the Department of Health. We've met with them twice last year following the allocation by Gauteng Treasury, and both occasions they gave the indication that they would be outsourcing these services as soon as possible. And at some point in June last year, the indication was that they would have outsourced the services at the latest by August 2023. And yet we sit in April 2024 and nothing has been done, and no service provider has been appointed, and no patient has gotten these services.
I mean, mind-blowing, isn't it? Salome, the impact that it's having on those who desperately need it?
That is, in fact, not easy to determine, because, quite honestly, we don't even know how many patients are actually still alive, because nothing is being communicated to patients. We also know that there's a large number of patients that are literally sitting at home waiting to hear anything. And then I think what is even worse, any new patient that gets diagnosed now, and if I say now, that's within the last year of services, all of those patients are being told that you will go onto a waiting list for radiation services. We think we need to actually do something else for you. And that something else is also not happening. So it is, quite honestly, I think for any cancer patient, to have been diagnosed with cancer is already a lot to deal with. However, then to hear that you have to wait. Wait for what?
And you've got to wait because of utter incompetence. I mean, it is mind-blowing, Kanyisa, and cancer patients don't have the time to wait. The 784 million rand that's sitting there, what impact could it make? What would be done with that money?
So what we're calling for is an integrated radiation oncology treatment. So what that looks like is that once a patient's gone through their chemotherapy and once they've gone through a surgery, if that's necessary, they would then go on to radiation oncology. And that is what is lacking in the public health system in Gauteng. And so what that includes is, you know, the mapping out of where the remaining cancer cells that haven't been killed by the chemotherapy are in the body. And then that would then, for lack of a better word, be zapped by the radiation that is then provided. And that, from what the experts have told us, can add about 10 years to someone's life before they even see a recurrence of their cancer. And essentially, that's what is the Department of Health is costing these people. Time with their family, time with their children, extended life is what it's costing them. And so a radiation oncology treatment would like I said, look like you know, the mapping of where the remaining cancer cells are, and then the provision of the radiation, and then after that, the person would have concluded their cancer treatment. So you know, what is also quite sad about this situation is that the Department of Health is really just failing these people at the last end of their treatment. You know, they've gone through the therapy, they've had the surgery in the system, and now they're waiting for just the last bit of treatment that will allow them not to have a recurrence. And what we're seeing with the patients that, you know, we do know of who walked this journey with us is that they are having these recurrences. They've had two, three recurrences as they're waiting. And what makes it even worse is that these patients then have to go back into the system, have to get more chemotherapy, have to get more surgeries, and that adds to the cost of treating cancer, and it also adds to the burden on the human body on top of the fact that you have cancer.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I believe you are taking to the streets later this month, and we'll certainly cover that. Well done on writing that letter, and let's hope that somebody is listening. Kanyisa Mapipa, head of health at Section 27, Salome Meyer, director, Cancer Alliance. We have been in touch with the health department. We are waiting for their response. They say that they will respond to us at some stage.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
So I don't know if you heard our bulletin a little earlier on. Bernadette Wicks was talking about the dire state of education in the Eastern Cape, or rather the dire state of access or no access at all to education there. And Bernadette Wicks is on the line for us, EWN reporter. Tell us what it is that you saw in the Eastern Cape and how hard it is for children to get to school.
Well, Jane, we spent a couple of days in the Eastern Cape and we were really focusing on the scholar transport issue, and that's against the backdrop of a case that the LRC and three SGBs and a local NPO have brought against government seeking scholar transport for thousands of children in the province who are entitled to it but aren't getting it. And so we spent time with some of these learners. We walked along the route home with one boy who walked home for several kilometers, sort of through the very rural landscape that the Eastern Cape is known for. We spoke to parents about the kind of desperate extremes that they've gone to try and foot the bill, in some instances going into debt with loan sharks for private transport. We also spoke to one woman who herself had dropped out of school because of the long walk when she was a child, and now she had fears that the same thing was going to happen to her own children because the situation in the village where she lives hasn't changed at all since she was a child, and there's still no scholar transport. So it was really devastating. It was really dire. I think what was really sort of moving was to see how passionate parents and teachers and learners themselves in these areas are, how they're willing to kind of work to overcome these massive challenges just for the opportunity to get an education and to go to school.
I mean, you quoted Mandela in your piece. He was saying we must reincalculate the culture of learning and teaching and make it possible for this culture to thrive. I mean, what you're seeing there, the opposite is true.
Absolutely. You know, in this situation, there's some people who have dropped out of school, who have literally just given up on the chance of getting an education because of this really sort of basic fundamental issue, which amounts to just being able to get to school to begin with before any of the other challenges that a lot of these communities face on top of this kind of come into play, things like overcrowding, things like the state of infrastructure at schools, things like under-resourcing, things like not having enough teachers for schools. This is really at the very start of the chain of events that need to take place in order for a child to get an education. All of this said, though, you know, I do think that we have to, it's important at least to look back on the education system that was inherited in 1994, because there have been successes that we can talk about as well. And it's important to recognize those successes. They become even more significant against the backdrop of that. And I did speak to Cameron McConaughey from the Legal Resources Center about that. The Legal Resources Center is representing the applicants in this case. And he spoke quite beautifully about where we come from, and quite powerfully and vividly. And I think we can take a listen to that.
30 years ago, the education system was very fractured. There were multiple departments of education along both terms of race within South Africa, but then there were also the former homelands of Transkei, Ciskei, Bophuthatswana, Tswana, etc. The new administration inherited a system that the funding of education was incredibly unequal. Black learners were receiving approximately 10% of the budget that white learners were receiving. And so there was a massive backlog in terms of the infrastructure in schools, the resources that were available, the number of teachers that were available in the different areas, the curriculums that differed. So it was really a big job to try and unify the country into one equal education system.
And we're hoping all of it can get a whole lot better. That was Bernadette Wicks with that update. We're going to be looking into 30 years of democracy. And our guest is Lwanda Traso, author and constitutional lawyer, founder of Including Society. And we're talking about an inspiring initiative marking South Africa's 30th anniversary of democracy. Letters from Tomorrow. Good afternoon to you. Tell us what this is all about.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me. Letters from Tomorrow, you know, it was inspired by the idea of how, you know, when you want to reflect on your life, usually the modality through which people do that is a letter to their younger self. You know, depending on how old you are, someone will say, you know, if you could talk to your 16-year-old self, what would you say, knowing what you know? So it's a similar idea, but the letter is addressed to South Africa, and it's basically asking people if you could go back to that moment where we're on the brink of starting this new journey, knowing what you know now, what does that moment actually mean versus what you thought it meant in that moment? And what would you say, you know, the last 30 years have meant, you know, and from the lessons that you've gleaned from the 30 years, what do you find important to relate back in time, if that makes sense? You know?
I should imagine the answers will be pretty illuminating. Can you elaborate on the selection process and what sort of figures were chosen?
So I'm, because of my legal background, there are a lot of sort of legal voices. Mm-hmm. There are some judges who participated. There are some business people who participated. And there are, there's a therapist, a psychotherapist that's participated. It's just people across the board. And part of this initiative is also calling on for more voices for people to write in to be featured in the Daily Mavericks newspaper at DM 168. If you send me a letter at lettersfromtomorrowsa@gmail.com, then your letter may appear, because this campaign is running up until the next election next month.
Okay, and what are you seeing here? What is a common theme or emotion that's driving this?
Disappointment is a common theme. Hurt is a common theme. But also, I think there's, you know, there's such different experiences that people have. For instance, I've written a letter as well, and mine will be featured tomorrow. And there is an acknowledgement that, you know, I have a life that's been enabled by certain changes that have happened. And I do want to acknowledge that. But, you know, you never want that to be exceptional. You want that to be quite commonplace. And one of the lessons we should have learned from apartheid is that when most of us are vulnerable, then all of us are vulnerable. So it's almost like, how do I make sense of my life and what I've been able to do in the last 30 years compared to other people who have been left out in so many ways, who have been deemed unworthy and unseen and unheard. So that's also a theme, a personal reflection of how has my life fared in the last 30 years, never mind just the collective journey.
Have you got a letter to read for us?
I'll read a part of mine, and then people can just get the Daily Maverick 168 tomorrow to read more. So it starts by saying, "Dear South Africa, I have heard from the chatter amongst the adults around me that today is the biggest of days. South Africa, these early years of my life have been overwhelmed by this very big and heady history in the making, which will become the spine of my future. Living through this history is both the greatest gift and the greatest curse of my life. My heart, mind, voice, and hands have all, for better or worse, been shaped by these days of darkness and light, violence and hope, fear and love, destruction and imagination, and endings and beginnings." I'll leave it there. If you want to read the rest of it, you can get the paper tomorrow.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Can you remind us of what the address is that people need to write to?
Yes, it's lettersfromtomorrowsa@gmail.com. lettersfromtomorrowsa@gmail.com. Please send me your reflections and we'll reprint them, republish them.
What a lovely idea. Luanda Kaso, thank you very much.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
So as I walked into the studio a little earlier on, Sidi Madia was walking out. She'd just interviewed Siviwe Gwarube from the DA, and Sidi was very excited about her message of 30 years of democracy. Let's listen to what she had to say, and you can find out more of this interview by tuning in to Sidi Madia's podcast.
Reflecting on the past 30 years is incredibly important, and a lot of people will equate the failures of the governing party to who we are as a country. And I think it's important to recognize that we are not our government. There are incredible things that we ought to be proud of where we come from. The fact that we managed to have a peaceful transition in 1994, the fact that we were able to have a constitution that will make sure that we will never go back to the days of apartheid, a constitution that is lauded across the country, across the world. And so it's important that we recognize that those are the achievements that South Africans had. And so even when we have in the face of a failing government, I think in this 20 to 30 years of democracy, we must understand that there's a lot that we have achieved. But it's now an important time for us to reflect about where do we take this, where do we take the next step? We've achieved political freedom. We've got universal suffrage. But there are still people who are going hungry to this day. There are still people who are unemployed, who cannot live a life of dignity. That has to be our obsession for the next 30 years. And so while we say happy birthday, South Africa, we've got a lot of work to do.
She's always got so much passion, hasn't she? Also in the studio, actually, is my mother who walked in to say hello. Hi, Mum.
Hello, darling.
All right, Brett Lindekew is the man who gives us some good news. He's going to present to us this week's Good Things Guide.
Good Things.
Good Things.
With Brent Lindekew.
Hey, what's happening, 702 and Cape Talk family? I'm actually coming to you live from the Mother City right now, and wow, it's really beautiful down here. So many great things happening in South Africa this week. We highlighted an organization that delivers 1,000 meals in a single day to those in need. A Hollywood star joined yoga classes for Lavender Hill learners. An artist brought joy to Sir Lowry's Pass Village. Gordon's Bay Post Office staff went above and beyond despite unworkable conditions. And we featured a foundation which is now caring for 530 turtles since those tragic Cape storms. That's just 5 out of the 100 stories we featured this week. Yes, you can catch these stories and many, many more on goodthingsguide.com. Until next week, like I always say, wishing you only good things.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
My mum's just said to me that maybe we should have a talk show, so I think it certainly bites, doesn't it? It's addictive. Let's listen to Hugh Masekela, Grazing in the Grass.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we playing that song? Well, it's beautiful. Hugh Masekela's Grazing in the Grass. Why? Because tomorrow is a very special day. It's Freedom Day, 30 years of this extraordinary democracy. I hope you're going to be going out there and celebrating along with the rest of us.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, it's been wonderful being with you today. We've covered a fair amount of ground. We were listening to the DA, what they say about 30 years of democracy, how they're going to change their economic landscape if they get into power, and how they're going to be giving us 2 million extra jobs. We were also talking about the dire state of the health and those cancer patients, 3,000 and more, who are in desperate need of any sort of assistance. We know that hundreds of millions of rand is set aside, and yet that money is not going to them to look after them. I mean, can you imagine? There must be nothing worse than hearing that you've got cancer, but that there is nothing to be done, that you cannot be helped, even though there is money sitting there waiting. I hope you're going to get out this weekend and enjoy your democracy, your Freedom Day celebrations. I know that there's a lot happening there, a lot of artistic events. And for me, Jane Dutton, and the rest of the team, thank you very much for listening.